We're going to start the committee. We're too short of a quorum, but as soon as we do, I'll officially convene us. First bill up on the agenda today is House File 3733, Representative Peterson. We won't be able to take any action at this point, but we can certainly start with the testimony. So why don't you come forward and ask perhaps your testifiers to come forward as well. We actually, members, began the testimony on this the last time we met, but we only heard from one individual at that time. And we have not heard, and that was an individual on behalf of the bill, so we haven't heard on the other side of this bill yet. So Representative Peterson, why don't you just get us going?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't remember. Did I move the bill yesterday?
No.
Or did we just have the testifier?
Right.
Just the testifier. Okay.
Right. Yeah. We'll move it in a few minutes.
And you want me to wait with moving the bill also?
Yeah. We'll wait till we have a quorum and then we'll do the official business.
Thank you. Well, as we said yesterday, this is a bill about trying to find some fairness and some clarity around the issue of Q comp. Everybody seems to feel that that particular program is a good program, worthy to be continued, but there seems to be some disagreement about some of the language that was actually put in the legislature a few years ago. And so I have with me today Jan Altswager, who is going to give testimony about this particular bill regarding alternative compensation, or Q comp by another name.
Thank you. And later on, we'll walk through the provisions of the bill. They're actually pretty simple, but pretty deep. Ms. Altswager, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Jan Altswager, Education Minnesota. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we had this bill before you last year in the form of an amendment. It was in the House bill. I want to give you some background. At that time, we were in litigation, and the department was concerned about having this pass or become law until the litigation was completed. So I want to give you an update on that first. Education Minnesota and Fox Center jointly filed, Fox Center School District and the union filed an application to be in the ATTPS, or Q-Comp program. The application was denied because they didn't meet some of the criteria that are outlined in this bill. And so then Education Minnesota and the school district, Fox Center, jointly filed a lawsuit. We lost the appeal. They denied our claim. We appealed to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and they chose not to hear the case. Therefore, the only remedy that we have is to either work something out with the departments, which we have been willing to do, or else to get a legislative remedy. Now to the reasons why we have supported QCOM. We have felt that it was a way to provide quality professional development for our teachers, for our members, you know, in a manner in which they negotiate with the school district, and all for the purpose of improving students' achievement. It was an opportunity to change. It's an opportunity to increase teacher pay, and some of it is based on performance. However, the interpretation by the department has not been in what we thought was consistent with the law. The department has said that you must eliminate steps and lanes, and we believe reform steps and lanes would not meet that same definition, but of course the court case said otherwise. That's why we're seeking a legislative remedy. And then the other issue is about the 60%, and I'm not sure if Representative Peterson wants to talk more about that. So I won't go into the depth about those two provisions at this point. But my main message is this. Education Minnesota would like to keep this as an opportunity for our locals to work with the school district on QCOMP or alternative teacher professional pay. The reality is our members have told us very clearly they are not interested, many of them are not interested in continuing in the program if the department's interpretations continue as they currently do. We held a conference last year. At the time, there were 32 of our locals in QCOMP. We invited all of them to come. 22 came to the conference. We explained to them the department's interpretation on eliminating steps and lanes and 60% tied to student performance, and we asked them how many of your contracts meet that, or you would change your contract to meet that. 17 of them said, we won't participate. So the purpose for this language is to keep QCOMP alive for those districts who are interested in continuing to pursue it.
Thank you, Ms. Altweiler. We are at quorum, and so I'm going to officially convene us. Representative Peterson, you wish to move your bill at this time? I assume so. So Representative Peterson moves House File 3733 be recommended to pass and referred to finance with a recommendation to re-refer to K-12 finance. So the bill is before us officially. Representative Peterson, do you have other testifiers? We only have one question, but I want to get your testifiers in, and then we'll stop and question then, and then we'll hear from others as well.
I don't believe we have any other testifiers, but we certainly are open to questions, and I think that Ms. Altweiler really touched on a couple of the key issues. One is whether, and point 2.9, it does, 2.8, excuse me, it does say reform the steps and lanes salary schedule. And it could be, and what does reform mean? Does that mean eliminate the experience in education, or does it mean putting those components together in a different way that includes performance pay and is a new structure that would work for that particular district and the contract that they negotiate? So I think that is one of the sticking points. And then obviously the other one, which has been talked about, I believe last year, a little deja vu here, was the 60-40, and whether the 60-40 alludes to only the alternative compensation pay over and above the other kinds of increases that are given to a particular school district, or is it all of the compensation, 60% of all of the compensation that is negotiated. And so at that, I think those are the two main issues. Now, I think the additional piece that you need to also note is on 2.28, which I'm very excited about, and that is an oversight committee that would look at the statutory processes of this particular program, and it would include Education Minnesota, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, the Department of Education, the School Board Association, and those are the main players. They are the folks who really sit down at the negotiation table, make decisions about what these contracts will look like and what these alternative compensation programs will contain in terms of contract language. So that kind of an oversight committee working with this program and then reporting back to the legislature, I think, is just an excellent piece, and I'm very pleased that this has been an addition to this particular language. With that, I would answer any questions that anyone on the committee might have.
Representative Peterson and/or Ms. Altweiler, it's my understanding that there's some type of a committee currently that looks like this. Is that true? And if so, how does what currently exists? How do we distinguish that from what's being proposed?
Well, I think this particular committee is very clear in terms of having the key players, only the key players who really understand what's going on in terms of this program, and have to implement it and then report back. As to other committees that might be formed by the department or any other group, you know, I'm not aware. I've heard rumors that there is another committee, and I'm not sure what their goal is, and maybe Ms. Altweiler can talk to that. The department probably could answer that more readily than I at this point.
Okay, very well. We have a question for Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, I'm a little late, and we had another committee and was running very late, so here I am. And if I am asking a question which has been covered already, I'm sure you will invite me, and I will move on.
Started, so okay. I'm sure you're good.
concerning this issue, first of all, I want to say that I represent a house district in which all three of the school districts are engaged in 2Comp and are very happy about it and are anxious that we do not lose that opportunity, and they and I see this program as a useful addition to what had been going on for many, many years. I, as you know, taught school for a long, long time, and we used to call some of the staff development programs dog and penny shows, because they seemed to have been, you know, produced at the last moment, and the administrative cadre had to come up with something, and so they would bring in a person and get a one-day presentation, and it really didn't do anything. So I like the idea of QCOMP because we have an ongoing program here. I was, before I retired, I was Education Minnesota local president in Edina Schools, so I wanted to live in the middle of the town. QCOMP was being introduced at that time, and Edina and the teachers there were interested. I was certainly interested in it, even beyond what I had just described before. But we negotiated the contract, and there were steps and lanes, and QCOMP, in our understanding, was an addition. It was a way to encourage teachers who might have been reticent otherwise to get engaged in improving their professionalism. It was never, as far as I can remember, even remotely tied into the idea that this system would somehow replace collective bargaining, the collective bargaining agreements that we had made. So I'd just like to ask a question of either of you. Is my interpretation of what went on and how QCOMP entered the arena confused or incorrect in some way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, obviously you negotiated it that way, and it was accepted by the department that way. I think that's where we get into some of the differences between districts and some of the concerns about this particular language, and actually some of the discussion that has gone over the past months around the language, which seems to be a bit confusing. And you obviously did some reform of steps and lanes, and you negotiated, but you did not eliminate. And my guess is, and I haven't looked at all of the 38 districts who have negotiated contracts, but my guess is they have not eliminated, all of them eliminated steps and lanes. Now, they might have restructured them, they might have implemented them in a different way. Obviously, they had to probably in order to be accepted. But I think that's where we're getting into some of this confusion and concern. And as the testifier, Ms. Altweiger, has said, if the department is going to say you have to eliminate all steps and lanes as a base for doing this, then we will have districts who will say, well, I'm walking away from that. And I don't think we want that. We really do want some kind of a base program, whether you call it a reformed steps and lanes or a base kind of pay schedule, and then you want to put the performance pay on top of that. Or you can maybe integrate it in some way. That's part of the negotiation process. And it seems to me here that both the department and Education Minnesota should be fairly close in terms of what they want, and should be able to look at this language and say, what makes sense? What will work to get what we want, which is a goal of better performance by teachers, to use better professional development, to integrate a performance pay program into their contract language, and to still have some assurance that there's some base of pay that won't be pulled out from under them if even the legislature decides they're going to take away the money for alternative compensation. So I would agree, Representative Benson, that you probably have a very good program in Edina, and one that gives your teachers much assurance.
Ms. Falslager.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, I can tell you that when this whole process was being discussed at the legislature, Education Minnesota was actually supportive of the concept. But we never once criticized it or said it should not pass. But we did say that it should meet four main criteria. That it should be locally negotiated, that the salaries should not be tied to test scores, that it not require elimination of steps and lanes, and that the funding should be available to everybody. And when the deal was negotiated, the House language said eliminate steps and lanes, and the Senate did not. And they came up with a compromise language which said reform. So I think clearly the intent of the legislation, reform does not mean eliminate, especially since you moved from the House position that was eliminate.
Thank you, Madam. That was going to be my second question. Is there something in statute which allows a director to come out to say what the local school districts now, when they negotiate contracts, are required to eliminate steps and lanes? Or isn't that language allowing that contractual activity to continue?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, I think as a result of the court case, the department has the ability then to define reform steps and lanes as eliminate. I think we argued that that was not the case. But the court case the decision has said that they could do that, that the department has the ability to make that interpretation.
Last point, Mr. Chair. So we should remember then that the legislature ought to have the last word on these issues, and that one court could rule one way and another court rules another way. And if the legislature concludes that the court made an interpretation which was contrary to the intent of the original law passed by the legislature could step in, could it not, and rectify that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I think that is true. And I would also say that this language does not say you must keep steps and lanes. It only says that it will include components in addition to experience and education credits, meaning that it does not have to look like the current steps and lanes. It provides an opportunity to locally negotiate a program that works for the local district and for the members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Benson. And Ms. Alford, you were referring to language on line 1.9 and 1.10 of the bill. We have two other members that have questions at this point. So let's put Demmer and Erickson. There are a number of other people who want to testify, including the department itself, I believe. And so I just want to know whether either of you wish to wait for that testimony, or is that...
Okay, very short.
Represent Demmer.
Yes, thank you. Thank
and I'm fine either way, but I just want to make sure that the other folks are available to answer your questions.
Sure, sure.
As well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good question, Representative Peterson. On 2.28, the Statewide Oversight Committee, you mentioned about groups that should be included in the committee, but you don't really say how many people are going to be on the committee. What was your intention in terms of the number of people on this Statewide Oversight Committee?
Representative Peterson.
I'm not sure. Would you repeat your question?
Well, you have a statewide oversight committee established, okay. And it says that a representative will be present from Education Minnesota, school board administrator, or school administrator, Department of Education, school board, so we have a representative. So it doesn't say how many people are going to be on the committee in total. Is that intended to be open? They can figure out for themselves how big?
Well, I think it's very clear that those entities have to be included because
right.
they are pretty intimately involved in this whole process. Could it include additional people? I don't think it excludes if there are some districts, perhaps, that they want to bring in. They're going to have to, I would think, have to bring in other districts for testimony. They're going to have to meet with other entities who are implementing QComp or alternative compensation. And so they may wish to expand the committee slightly.
Yep.
That is an option. It doesn't, but it certainly says that these have to be, and they have to have a representative. Each of those entities have to have a representative.
Well, I
understand. Is that what you're...
Thank you. No, I understand that each have to have a representative, but you don't say who establishes the committee, and you don't say how many people totally make up the committee. I'm just curious. Is it intended just to be before people?
Mm-hmm.
Before representatives, or will it be a committee of 12 with these?
We would have to look at any amendment that you would propose, because what we really want to do is get, all we need is one person from each one of these organizations, and you can see that we're not looking for any extra power here, because we're, you know, we have two administrative groups and the teacher group and the department. We just want to have a dialogue that is required so that we actually can discuss issues that are problematic or that are working well.
Well, again, please don't misinterpret my question. I don't have a problem with these four. I'm just wondering how many in total will be on the committee and who decides.
Mr. Chair, Representative Demers, sometimes I know that these boards list one member of Education Minnesota, one member of the School Board Association, and if you feel that clarity is needed, we would certainly be open to clarifying that. But all I think this is our Education Minnesota needs, I think, is to have one person, and then if there's agreement by the parties that, you know, we bring in the right people for the right subject, that could occur.
Very well. We have other individuals that have asked to testify on the bill. Paul Mueller.
I don't think Mr. Mueller will be here today. Okay. Thank you.
We heard from Kate Schmidt last time. I still have her on the list. Stacia Smith and Mike Salvini.
Mr. Chair, Kate Schmidt is here and available for questions, but she did testify yesterday, so she is not planning to testify again today.
Why don't we do this, members? Why don't we? My understanding is the department does wish to testify. Perhaps this is a good time to hear from the department, and then we have the two individuals, Ms. Smith and Mr. Bartholomew, who have also asked to testify. But perhaps at this point, we'll ask the department to come forward and offer their thoughts and wisdom on House File 3733.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Kaz Anderson, Deputy Education Commissioner. First of all, I just want to clarify the court case, Stock Center Education Association versus the state of Minnesota. In no way did the state ever advocate that the language gave us the authority to demand districts eliminate the steps and lane salary schedule. Our issue was that they need to reform or restructure the salary schedule as the definition of reform. Some have done it in very ways that have been way beyond, or have eliminated steps and lanes, others have not. So I just wanted to clarify our position. Also, the court did not grant us the authority in their case to allow us to demand that all school districts eliminate steps and lanes. They agreed with the state's position that the district needed to reform the steps and lanes salary schedule in order to gain approval from the state. I'm just going to comment on the 60% rule, and the commissioner will talk about the language reforming the steps and lanes salary schedule. The 60% rule, actually, just kind of the history of this legislation, came actually from the Senate. This was something that Senator Kelly had pushed. We accepted that provision under the understanding, and I think Senator Kelly has confirmed this, that it was 60% of increases are based on all revenues. And I want you to think about how, first of all, it's very complicated because what this does here is say it's 60% of alternative teacher compensation, the state aid that is part of general education. What this will do is, and I don't pretend to say that the finance scheme for education is simple, so I'm going to try to make this as simple as possible, but what this will do is, if you know, employees are federally funded, they're state funded, they're funded by referendums, and when a district settles a contract with its union, they don't delineate who gets what increases based on your source of funding. It's either everyone gets the 2% each year, and then they adjust their budgets accordingly to pay for that. What this will do is require districts to take state aid and apply it to federally funded employees for their performance pay, because districts and teachers are not going to negotiate performance pay for some teachers because they're state funded and not negotiate it for federally funded employees. It doesn't work that way. And what will happen is once you shift the state funding onto, and this is the example I'll use, the special education, then that district is on the hook to maintain effort in that case for that year and the year on out. And so if there was a situation where this money went away, the district would be responsible for maintaining that same level of expenditure for years on out. And so I won't say that the 60% provision isn't problematic to implement. It can be difficult. We're willing to work with Education Minnesota to come up with language that simplifies it. I understand the concerns, but we have concerns that it will actually make it more complicated, more difficult, and actually cause a financial problem in the future for school districts because of that provision in the special education law. Commissioner, if you want to...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In regards to reforming the reception lanes, it has always been our intent that there would be a base structure. In fact, indeed, the language also says that no teacher would ever lose their whatever salary that they were currently making as you negotiate a reform step and lanes system. We believe that we need to have some additional reform to our pay structure. If you think about what's going to be happening in the future, about 40% of our teachers are projected to leave the profession with retirement in the next 10 years. That's a huge number of teachers that are leaving, and we have to face the fact that we have a lot of Generation X, Y, and Zers that are going to be out there wanting to come into a teaching profession, but under the old structure of not having the recognition and the ability to move through a salary structure that's going to recognize their skill and their way of educating children in a way that is much like the private sector, is I think going to diminish our chances of attracting the best and the brightest into the profession. I've mentioned many times the McKinsey report that talked about how top performing countries look at their teaching profession. They honor it, but they also insist that only the best and the brightest enter the profession, and then they are paid commensurate to their ability to perform in the classroom. They also have the professional development opportunities that we think are really, really important for our teachers, and it has made a difference in our QCOM districts. So we are very, very concerned that the interpretation or the structure or the attitude that we are eliminating step lanes is a misconception, but we do want to have reform that is based on evaluation, continuous improvement of our teachers, and have some linkage to, after all, what is happening in the classroom academically with our students. That is what teaching is all about. That is the bottom line. And so we do think that it's important. We have negotiated this on a bipartisan basis over the last few years. The teachers that are in these programs, they talk about how it has changed their lives and that they really are thriving and appreciate the experience that QCOMP is giving them. Representative Benson, you mentioned negotiating a salary structure in Edina. That has nothing to do with QCOMP, as I understand. This is something that was outside and even before QCOMP was even implemented. So that I want to clarify that Edina is not in the QCOMP program and was something that you did, and that's what your district chose. We appreciate the opportunity to respond to this. As far as the Oversight Committee, we already, Representative Mariani, you had mentioned, doesn't the department have one? Yes, we do, and it is comprised of this membership, and we actively engage them in working with us and reviewing the QCOMP applications and getting their input. We feel it is very important to have that kind of relationship, and we will continue to do that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Susan, I have problems with this new language of the Oversight Committee and not its line 2.28 and what follows. I think all those players, including the department, are much too close to the issue that's at hand. For example, in reviewing letters of intent and the programs that may be approved or disapproved. So I'm just wondering what you would think of having an outside group. Maybe that's what you have now, because you didn't explain exactly what your oversight group is. But how about having those who are trained in what the statute requires and then having them, having four persons there review these applications, because they're going to be neutral on all of it. My concern is, you know, looking at that membership group which promotes the negotiation of salaries, that representative of the school board, and those are the two who are always at the bargaining table. So let's get them out of there. And school administrators, they kind of fall in between. And then I suppose, you know, you're considered then the advocate for the statutory language, not because you're the department, but because you're the author of the bill. So, you know, at present, I have a problem with maybe what you do as well as what's stated here. So would you comment on whether that's a possibility?
And my understanding is you said that early all these individuals are currently at a table.
Yes.
And so what I'm curious about is whether, in the new language, whether the individuals, and this is, I believe, in keeping with your question, whether the current committee is a group is expected to do the similar language, or rather similar responsibilities that we see in the new language in the bill.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Deputy Commissioner Anderson can speak to both of your questions. Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the TCOMP Advisory Committee, as we call it, consists of all of the education organizations listed here, plus a few more, such as AMSB and MREA, et cetera. And it also includes a variety of representation from districts currently implementing the QCOMP program. We try to get a geographical balance between rural districts, metro districts, small districts, large districts. So all the issues are represented at the table. In terms of 1 through 3, 1 and 2, certainly they do. Take a look at the process. They advise the commissioner on how things are going in the district and the application process. We've revised that a couple times based on their advice. Some of them also participate in reviewing the applications. We also make sure that when the applications are reviewed, it's done by administrators and teachers from existing implementing districts, and they go through and review that and make recommendations to the commissioner. The commissioner actively participates in this group, and so they have direct access to give her sort of unfettered advice about implementation from the state level and implementation at the district level. I would say they do 1 and 2. They don't submit currently a report to the legislature. That's number 3. I certainly could probably do that and get that done by February 1st. But what we would encourage is that to have more representation than just the education organizations, to have districts actually that are implementing the program, because they really know sort of what's working, what's not working, and provide us with valuable input.
So, Mr. Chair, Deputy Commissioner, you would not see a value in having outsiders, those totally out of the realm of education, as being valuable members of an oversight.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I do believe actually the Chamber of Commerce and the Minnesota Business Partnership have participated. Actually, some of their members have been part of the review application process. And they can, Mr. Bartholomew, you can talk more in detail what how they participated, but we've had the business community has been engaged in this process as well.
And Mr. Chair, one question for the Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Segrin, is there an accountability piece in QCOMP so that there is a review cycle by someone to see that what the plan was that was submitted to the department and approved now is implemented, carried out, and that there is a result? I mean, that's probably in the works, because not any one of them has been in place that long. But can we look forward to that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, actually we have instituted, we call it a peer review process, and it's those that are currently implementing the QCOMP program, along with department staff, go out and review each other's programs and provide feedback for improvement or things they're doing well. And those reports are available for each school district. It's a tiered system, so once a district has good reports, then the peer review process doesn't happen annually. You're right, we have most of our districts started last school year, so there's not a lot of data yet on improvement, but one of the things we look at is the state test scores. They also do their own reporting with their local assessments that they may be doing. And so that's sort of the process we've implemented. At this point, we've not seen any non-compliance.
Some districts, after implementing, decide, you know, maybe we want to do it a different way, and they submit changes to their application, which we accept. And I think the most powerful point of the peer review, actually, is districts come back and say, you know, yeah, we reviewed the program, but I learned a lot about this district's program that I want to take back to my own school district. So that's, it's also been sort of a best practices for those existing school districts to see how it works.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. And Mr. Chair, too, the other thing that we are interested in is, over time, as UConn continues, actually looking at the impact on academic achievement. And we recently, for Senator Torres Ray, she's been looking at the achievement gap, and we were asked to look at kind of beat the odds schools and those that, you know, have really done some extraordinary things. And we had kind of a, I don't know if it was the top 10 or top 25 list of school districts. Out of that list that we created for her, many of them were UConn schools. Now, can we attribute that already to that? We don't know yet. But we do know that in the Minneapolis School District, where there have been implementation going on for at least 4 years or so, many of those schools with high poverty, high diversity, are doing extraordinary things and are beating the odds. And it is, I think, because of the opportunity to have teachers be able to look at the data around their students, really look at best practices, go into their classrooms, try those things and continually improve and see, use the strategies that are really going to make a difference with kids. So we do think it's making a difference.
The question for Officer Bettman and Benson, and I'm going to go to the other testifiers, and then we're going to go to a vote.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this is for either Commissioner Seguin or Deputy Commissioner Anderson. You know, my school has two comp, and they're in their second year, and they've approved it again for the next go around. And how many school districts right now are participating in two comp, whether they're school districts or charter schools? How many are now currently involved in the two comp program?
We have, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. And Representative Detmer, we have 38 school districts, and I think we have 12 charter schools that are in that, 13? 15, okay. And that represents almost 40% of our school population now.
Okay.
So, and we have them from all over the state. We have rural, medium-sized, so it's in metropolitan. It represents a wide variety and types of school districts.
So, Commissioner, 40% of our student enrollments are covered by those schools.
Yes.
That,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up.
Quite, but almost.
Of the districts that are currently in QCOP, have there any districts dropped for QCOP, and do they give you reasons why they drop?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, the one school district that I know of did drop out, and a lot of things have been attributed to that. They had a change in their teacher union leadership, their superintendent, and their HR director, who negotiated the plan. I think there were concerns about implementation, and some of the teachers were unhappy with some of the implementation. But again, it's a voluntary program, and teachers in the district can decide, you know, to no longer implement the program. This one district has dropped.
One quick follow-up then. So basically, it's a locally organized program, so it really is up to that local school district to put together the best program and get approval through the Department of Education for their teachers and their students, correct?
Mr. Chair, Detmer, it is the state statute provides what we called, when it was first put together, a framework. So you have to meet the five components of the statute. But the design of those components is completely negotiated at the local and district level. Mm-hmm. And then they submit that to the state for approval. So you're not going to see every program look exactly the same. And they're not going to pay their teachers the same. They're going to set up their staff development probably a little differently. And even within the district, the schools may set up things a little differently based on high schools do not operate like elementary schools. So within a district, you'll find some variability in some of those issues.
Thank you.
Representative Benson, and I believe Representative Brown also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Real quickly, just a brief comment about IDINA again. IO is already retired from Medina, I guess, by the time QCOMP came in, although I was an advocate of it, of doing something similar to that. And I'm just wondering what portion of the K-12 budget presently goes into QCOMP. What percentage or what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, the total funding for the QCOMP program per year is about $78 million. And so the budget for K-12, I think we're at about, I think, $7.5 billion. So that's a very small percentage of the budget. Also, I will add that QCOMP requires alignment. It's with your staff development 2% set-aside. So if you're in the program, you need to use your staff development set-aside for the purposes of delivering the professional development required in QCOMP, so that's additional funding as well.
Okay. So it's a modest program in a sense. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. So it's a modest program, money-wise, anyway. What percentage of that would you say is coming from local property tax?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, it's currently in current law $260 a student, $190 a student is state aid, $70 as levy, as an equalized levy, so it depends on your property tax base, whether or not you have to levy the full 70 and not receive aid. It is a voluntary levy, so we do have some school districts that have opted not to levy it or levy a portion of the $70 per student, but that's how the program is financed currently.
Sure. So for most school districts that are participating in QCOMP, there is a property tax impact.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, most districts have elected to levy the $70.
Right.
That's correct.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Marani, I just wanted to say that I teach in a QCOMP school. I have QCOMP schools in my district, and of course there's in the surrounding districts there are QCOMP schools as well, and the experience in our area has been very positive. I was talking to a certain superintendent this morning, even, who was telling me that he was renewing his forms, and I just wanted to say that we've been very happy with the department's efforts to work with schools to make sure that they are in compliance. Change is difficult, and I think trying to move somewhat away from the old idea of steps and lanes is difficult, and I do applaud those schools that are attempting that.
Thank you. We're going to hear now from Stacia Smith and Jim Bartholomew, and then hopefully members will be ready for vote. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani and committee members. I'll make my testimony very brief. I just want to be on record. Oh, Stacia Smith, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just want to go on record saying that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce does oppose this bill. We have talked with Representative Peterson. She's been wonderful to work with, and we're hoping that through the department and the union will be able to figure out this language. But the bottom line is our number one concern is the 60% component on lines 210 and 211, and that's of course, going back to that 60% of total increase in pay would be performance-based pay, and changing that to 60% of only this incremental $260 per pupil. I think this drastically reduces the impact of this change, and as Representative Brown said, change is difficult, and we are supportive of this change. So this bill would, in our minds, go against that change. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I'll try and keep my testimony very brief as well. And as Ms. Anderson mentioned, we've supported QCOMP since its inception. It does create opportunities for educators to create and participate in professional development. And it does help to shift compensation away from a system based solely on steps and lanes. And as Assistant Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Anderson mentioned, when the program was adopted in its first year with grant applications from districts, We did offer to recruit and did provide some of our member companies' top executives to help in the grant review process. And if anyone wants to know more about that, I'd be happy to expound. But it was something we felt was very important and wanted to help facilitate. Our main concerns, and they've been touched on, and I'd also like to thank Representative Peterson. She's been wonderful to work with. But the new language on lines 1.9 and 1.10, which seem to require any district participating in QCOMP to have steps and lanes. And as was mentioned in the earlier testimony, when they did the survey of the 22 districts participating in QCOMP in a summer activity, five of the districts said they had gotten rid of steps and lanes. If this bill were to pass, what would happen to those five districts that had voluntarily moved beyond that? And the language on 2.10 to 2.11 does seem to really increase or limit the increase in compensation for student or for teacher performance to only the amount of revenue available through QCOMP. And I guess just in closing, the cumulative effect of the new language in Section 1 and Section 2 is just it really restricts the ability of the law and participating districts to make change. And we'd like to try to keep the options open as much as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't read the word reform as eliminate steps and lanes. So I guess I would disagree with you. In our district, a long time ago, I used to be part of the negotiating team. We tried to shrink them way down because we didn't like the idea of a teacher waiting 25 years to get to the top of the salary schedule. When I saw QCOMP come through, I got excited wishing I was still teaching because I thought some teachers are better than others and they should be paid more. And if there's any opportunity for a good teacher to rise in both prestige but mostly salary, I said, let's go for it. And I think if you want to say eliminate steps and lanes, I would say, well, what about one step and one lane? It's still there. So I like the idea. Now, for the Chamber of Commerce, I love the Chamber of Commerce. I love small business especially. You need a qualified workforce, an educated, qualified workforce, but to get that, you need good teachers, and teachers are either leaving the profession or not coming into it because the salary is so low, and I see QCOMP as a way to entice good teachers into the system once again, and my superintendent, who I think is really good, we get along quite well, and my teachers want this bill. And I don't want to see QCOMP die. So if we can, if the 60%, I think that's the most argumentative piece of this bill. And I understand the Chamber's view on that. But I just hope the department and the authors of the bill can keep working together because this bill, we don't want to lose QCOMP. And there's no way I vote no on this bill.
Thank you. I think it's more of a comment than a question. I'm going to ask Representative Peterson to come forward. Thank you, Ms. Smith. Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you.
And then Representative Erickson, I believe you have a question for Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, would you define what you mean by components in line 1.9?
I did. Yeah. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson. Components, as you put together these alternative compensation packages, they're restructured in many ways, and there can be different kinds of components of learning, of how you achieve your increases. It could be maybe it's a component that includes some professional development. Maybe it's a component that includes mentoring. There are different components depending upon what is negotiated at a local level. And so I think it varies from district to district, and whatever contract that is negotiated is sent to the Department of Education.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think it's a poorly constructed sentence, but we won't go there, so that could be, I would edit it if you go forward with this, Representative Peterson. I would definitely edit that piece. So my last question is, don't you think by the new language you're adding in 210 and 211, it's a kind of gutting what performance pay is about?
Representative Peterson.
Well, no, I would have to, I simply answer no. Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, no. You know, and maybe I should just make my comment here, because as I'm listening to the testifiers, everybody's agreeing this is a good program. Everybody's agreeing we want to continue it. It is something for the future, and we need to make it work. And as I listened, it seems to me we even agree on what reform is, and that we're not even arguing over reform and elimination of steps and lanes, etc. I think the only piece that we're, and my guess is that there could be a cast of 800 that is not, that's exaggerating, but a huge committee that could come together to deal with many of the pieces of alternative compensation, and still have an oversight committee with these four groups who really represent most of the players that are negotiating at the table, and could report back, and they could exist side by side. I think the main sticking point in language probably is the 60-40, and that 60% and the 40%, and I think that is the sticking point. And I think they're all, as I have listened over the past days, it's interesting how everybody interprets language in a different way. And they come from a perspective of what they're dealing with in terms of how they interpret what it means. And I am hoping that we can have some discussions before the next committee even, and is there any way that we can get language here that will work and understand what each side means by the 60-40, because that seems to be the really only sticking point that I can see. And so with that, I think we all want to move forward on this and make it work.
Because then when you get the last question, then we're going to move to the vote here.
Yeah, I guess that's my biggest concern. You know, I think we have a good program, and if it works, if it works, why change it? And that's why I would probably be against the language here on line 210 and 211.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think the reason that this is brought forth is because we do have districts who are concerned about the interpretation of the language, and if indeed it's going to be interpreted strictly 60 and 40 and implemented that way, they may first of all choose not to apply, or some of them may withdraw. At least that's what we're hearing as the reasons for bringing this forward. So again, we need to be real clear about language so that everybody knows how to get into the program, how to work with the program, and how to improve it.
Very well, members. I want to thank you for the discussion. I had not intended to take this long on this bill, and at this pace, we'll get out of here at 6 or 7 tonight. But nonetheless, it's a good discussion. These are big issues, they're tough issues, and it's important that we talk them through, and just as important that we hear each other as we talk them through, and the committee certainly, I think, has done that this afternoon. Representative Peterson, we need your motion that House File 3733 be recommended to pass and refer to Finance for the recommendation to be referred to the K-12 Finance Committee. That's the motion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Representative Welty, House File 3403. Representative Ralphie, you're going to move the House File 3403, be recommended to pass, and we're also sending this to K-12 Finance I believe. So the motion would be to refer to finance with recommendations to K-12 finance. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm going to describe House File 3403, and then I'll turn it over to the two testifiers that are with me today. And there will be an amendment that will be proposed, but let me describe the bill as it currently is, because I'm going to leave it up to the will of the committee to decide whether or not the amendment should go on. The current bill in front of you, House File 3403, would essentially require that we add assessment to the current assessment that we give students for sciences. Right now, current Minnesota law requires that we have standards in earth, life, and physical sciences for all students in grade 10 through 12. But the assessment that we have for science is only based on the life science. So what we want to do is, within the assessment, we also want to assess students on the earth and physical science, which is the current standard, but that we don't assess students on within the current assessment. So the current language that you have in front of you on House File 3403 does not require an additional test. And this was to just revise the current test, as I've stated before. This does not add any new standards. This language does not add any new standard, and besides that, it does not change the course requirements for students. So we are only talking about changing or modifying the current assessment for the sciences to include the comprehensive sciences that our students are taught in their secondary experience. And so with that, I'm going to turn over the testimony to Kent Gordon, who is with the Minnesota Earth Science Teachers Association. And then also John Olson is here, and he works within the St. Paul Public Schools and has also been a former board member of the Minnesota Science Teachers Association.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Welty. Welcome, Mr. Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kent Gordon. I am the president of the Minnesota Earth Science Teachers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of broad-based, inclusive, and comprehensive science standards assessment today. I'm the current president of the Minnesota Earth Science Teachers Association and an executive board member for the past 10 years. I've been a science teacher since 1995 and have been actively involved in site implementation of the Minnesota academic standards. I'm here today to share the position of two of the elected boards of two of the state's largest science teacher organizations, the Minnesota Earth Science Teachers Association and the Minnesota Science Teachers Association. These two boards represent over 1,200 science educators from across the state. Let me begin by saying that we are pleased with the 2004 Minnesota Academic Standards in Science. All students are required to meet all standards in Earth and Space, Life Science, Physical Science, and History and Nature of Science. They represent a basic level of science literacy for all Minnesotans. We're also pleased with the 5th and 8th grade MCA testing plan. These tests reflect the inclusive and comprehensive nature of the required standards and include questions in Earth, Life, and Physical Science. All standards are required for all students, and all students are currently tested in all standards in 5th and 8th grade. Let's turn to some charts that show the number of questions for those each discipline of science. The first chart is for grades 3 to 5. The bars indicate the number of questions in each area. The red bar is the history and nature of science, the green is physical science, the yellow is earth science, the blue is life science. This represents the 5th grade test. We also have the 8th grade test, which follows a similar pattern. Once again, you can see all sciences are represented in more or less equal amounts. However, at the high school level, if we hold up the chart for that at the same time, the picture is very different. The high school assessment is merely life science and the history and nature of science. So unfortunately, current law limits the grade 10 to 12 MCA questions to fairly narrow focus on life science and the history and nature of science, though all standards are already required for all students. It makes sense to revise the high school assessment to include earth and physical science test questions, much like the 5th and 8th grade test. This would provide a more complete and fair assessment of student achievement in science. Testing would then more closely reflect the complete range of existing required standards. A broad-based high school assessment but also make it possible to consistently monitor student achievement in all areas of science for a longer time. MCA results should then be used to inform curriculum and instruction decisions across all the standards from the elementary to the high school level. Finally, we believe a fair evaluation of student achievement is best done with assessment questions which sample the full range of high school science standards. We ask that you support this bill and allow us to test it that fits the comprehensive nature of the required standards. Rest assured, we're not asking for additional course requirements. We also acknowledge that it will take funding and time for the Department of Education to develop new test questions. Now is the time to act, as the Department of Education's existing schedule includes a 2012 test revision, and time is needed to prepare a quality assessment in advance. As science teachers, we only ask that the next assessment include questions that are more representative of student achievement than the full range of required standards. Thank you for your time. Should you wish to contact your information, you may find it, contact our organizations. The information is on the MESTA and MINSTA position statements. Thank you again for your time and consideration. We'd be happy to take any questions and we appreciate the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. Mr. Olson?
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Olson. I am the Science Program Manager for St. Paul Public Schools. I'm a previous physical science and earth science teacher, and I'm currently serving on the State Revision of Science Standards Committee. I'm also past president of the Minnesota Science Teachers Association, so I'll be supporting their statement and representing our president, who teaches in Parkers Prairie and is not able to be here today. Minnesota Science Teachers Association, as you know, as you heard, has about 1,000 members, K-16, who teach and have followed the development of the science standards and the science assessments very closely. Our board has 33 members throughout the state, and they have affirmed our position backing this legislation. As a science administrator for St. Paul Schools, I also know that the way that things are assessed has a big impact on curriculum and the way we teach. Our high school students need quality coverage of all the standard areas as they work towards going into the workforce as members of our high-tech industries, such as 3M, which is a current partner of our district. It is essential that students are literate in all the core areas of science and engineering, not just the biological area. In this area of accountability, what gets assessed is what is emphasized in instruction. The biology-based test is having an impact on our curriculum in our high schools. Many of our advanced science students have been taking biology at the ninth grade level and chemistry at the 10th grade level, so they're aligned carefully for advanced placement in international baccalaureate courses. Because in most districts, the assessment is placed at the 10th grade level, many of these students have to change their plans to fit into that that restriction, and this limits opportunities for our students. So it seems rationale to be continually reinforce the fundamental sciences of physical science and earth science, and if we want our Minnesota students to be well prepared, it's important that they have all these areas. I understand from Senator Kelly that the original decision to make the high school assessment biology-based was made hastily under a deadline of the end of the session a few years ago, and it was an attempt to be less intrusive into the high school course offering than to cover all areas, since biology is the only subject that is required currently. This bill allows the opportunity to adjust that decision upon fuller understanding of the skills students need for our global economy. There'll be an amendment that you'll be introducing which will talk about the idea of doing end-of-course assessments rather than assessing everybody on all the standards all at once. The Department of Education Testing Office has been behind this move to break the test up into possible tests that are administered at the end of courses. So we think this is a good opportunity and an innovative way to bring this forward. Thank you for your attention, and we're glad to answer questions about this.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative Walsky.
I want to give the members of the committee just a little bit of history on this. Last year, this bill was brought to me. It was moved in the Senate, and I went back and listened to the testimony in the Senate, and at that time, there there really wasn't any controversy to the bill. The bill passed out of committee, but because of time, I wasn't able to bring it forward in the House. The language was brought forward to me then over the summer. I agreed to carry it. The Senate again took this language up just last week, I believe, or just this week? On Wednesday, the Senate moved this language and passed it out along with the amendment that you see before you. So they debated it, and it was passed out of committee. So just so all of you know that there has been support for this legislation. Now, this amendment, and I'm just going to, Mr. Chair, for the purpose of this committee, refer to it as the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment was brought to me 15 minutes ago, and I looked at it as, from a teacher's perspective, I can see the value in breaking up the current assessment into three different assessments so that the students are tested right after they take their course. But I also look at this as then we will have additional tests, and when the original bill was brought before me, or brought to me, it was just one assessment. So as I'm going to, you have the language in front of you. You know what this is about. It essentially takes the current language and says instead of one assessment, we're going to break it up into three different assessments so that you'd be assessed after your biology course, your earth and space course, and your physical science course. And so with that, I will turn it over to the committee to debate that amendment.
Wonderful. Thank you. And your desire with the amendment at this point is...
Mr. Chair, I am neutral on this amendment right now, and the Department of Education, the Department of Education is here.
Why don't we hear from the Department of Education at this point? Mr. Erickson, you would ask the tough question. New style.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one of the reasons why we requested this change is because this sort of goes back to the whole debate we had at the 2004 conference committee. Very late in the morning, or early in the morning, I will say, and one of the things we struggled with is what grade to put the science assessment in, because as you know, that we have to test once in elementary, once in middle school, once in high school. We test in fifth grade, eighth grade, and then where to put it in high school. And a lot of districts, actually education organizations, provided advice that the science course sequence isn't always the same in every district, and actually there's a movement to move physics earlier and biology later. And if the department went in and just prescribed what grade you were going to put it in, then we're just basically telling you your course sequence. So so that's why we picked end of course biology, because it, and then the district takes assesses the students when they're end of the course. One of the issues we have with just having one assessment is then again we have to pick which grade to put it in, and then we're having, and if we want to encompass all of the subjects that is listed in the bill, we would probably have to put it in 11th grade or 12th grade. And then we're testing kids on courses they took in ninth grade. And so there's a huge delay of when they took the course and when they took the assessment. So that's why, you know, we've been working with UNFOLC, and I value why they want it, because I actually think we have a great science assessment. It's online, it's interactive. We've gotten a lot of great feedback from teachers on it. And the only way to sort of solve this conundrum is to go to having an end of course exam, and then the districts do not have to change their course sequence. They can give the assessment when they want it. It's outside of our accountability system, so their AYP status is not impacted by the science assessment, and it's a way to have some innovation in assessments and have some instructionally based assessments.
Representative Demers. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. One's very quick. I noticed in the amendment, I know we're talking about an amendment that hasn't been moved, Mr. Chair, but, well, I'm going to discuss it anyway. I'm going to do it anyway. Yeah, that's right, Friday. I do have a quick question. In the amendment, it says biology, earth and science, and physical science. And in the bill, it says earth and science, life, and physical sciences. We got life in place of biology. Does that make any difference, for one thing? Maybe that's something to talk about later. That's a more of a wordsmithing type of a thing. Is there a purpose for the difference?
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, it's semantics. It's essentially the same. We really look at the standards. All of our assessments are going to be aligned to standards. So whatever we have for standards, assessments will be aligned to those standards. So And then the district will, under this case, if we adopt the amendment, would give the assessment when they, when the student finishes the course.
Okay, Mr. That's my real question. Is it my understanding then, Deputy Commissioner, that this would be an end of course test, maybe not unlike what maybe the instructor gives anyway, and in a certain sense, could this assessment, this test, if you will, be almost eliminating a test, because we wouldn't have, do we still have the standards test in addition to the end of course test?
Yeah.
Or would we now have an end-of-course test for each one that would eliminate the standards test? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, that's a local decision. They could do that.
Right.
We've really tried to design our science assessment to be instructionally interactive, and so, you know, that's something that they could make the decision to do, and they could do.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm thinking, and I agree with that, but I guess in this case, we can make the assumption that an instructor would probably give an end-of-the-course test anyway, a final, if you will, and that then could be this assessment. And then in the end, you'd actually, assuming if that instructor gave those anyway, you'd actually be eliminating an assessment than if we don't do the overall one, the way I'm seeing this, unless I'm wrong about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, you're correct. And our tests are built by Minnesota teachers. So science teachers will come in and work with us on item development, alignment to standards. And so they should feel confident that Minnesota educators had a say and help build our tests.
Assistant Commissioner, you were speaking earlier about the AYP count. Science currently, is that an AYP? Does that count for AYP determination?
Mr. Chair, science is not part of the AYP calculation. That's separate outside of the accountability system.
Thank you. Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The more I listen, the more I like this amendment. Perhaps I can. I know. I'm ready to move it, but perhaps to get him back in the good graces of the Department of Education, I probably irritated them and they will. I'll move them if they want me to. But just a comment on what President Dover was talking about. Anytime you can eliminate a test, especially if that the test the kid takes also counts for his final grade in that class, he or she will study much harder for that test. I'm all for that. So I move the amendment, if I may.
Mr. Wardlaw moves the, not quite sure how we were characterizing this amendment, but now it'll have a formal characterization. The language is passed out. It's XXXX. Page 1920 after the period insert. Each assessment given in the high school grade span will be administered at the end of the course for which science standards assessment is completed in each content area of biology, earth and space, and physical science. I don't know if that's technically an oral amendment or not. It's not coded here, but that's the amendment before it. Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty or whomever can answer this question. With this assessment, what is the turnaround time? If a child, a high school student, takes the test in biology, let's say, what is the turnaround time for the teacher to be able to use that information as a grade? I mean, if we're talking about using it as maybe a substitute for a final test, is that reality or is that fiction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkham, this is scheduled to be part of the test in 2012. So we're currently revising the science standards right now, and then this test will be aligned to the new revised standards. Because we immediately went online with this test, starting actually this year will be fully operational, we actually expect to get results back much quicker, and we believe that once we have and as years go on, we're going to have better experiences with technology and be able to get results back much quicker. In addition, this is not part of our AYP calculation, and so it doesn't have to go through all of the checks needed as we go through math and reading. And our math and reading tests are paper pencil, so all of that needs to be scanned, etc. Versus the technology, we can get more instantaneous results. It probably won't be immediately after they take it, but it will be within a time period that happens within the school year, and then the teacher can use that as part of, as representing Denver side, a final grade or a final assessment if they wish to. And so we think that we actually can get results back pretty quick because, as I said, it's not part of the accountability system. And the second thing is that it's already an online assessment, and by the year 2012, we know we will have a lot more better data and technology to even get results back quicker than we'll have this year.
Representative
Spoker. Mr. Chair, can I, can you give me just a little more time frame there? Because you just, what I heard you say, and I could be wrong, is that within the school year, the teacher will get results back. If you're using it as a substitute for a final test or for a semester grade, then the reality is it isn't very usable for that, so it is an additional step.
Mr. Chair, Representative Spoken, I really can't look to the future and give an exact time, and it's going to depend too when we place our testing window, and we do not have the exact same testing window for science right now as we do for reading and math. And so if we had, for instance, the testing window that happened in late April, it would be much easier for us to get results back in May then, that the teacher could incorporate that as part of a final grade. But once, if you go to the end of May, it gets a little bit more difficult. But it depends on a lot of different factors. I know, I wish I could give you, it's going to be 1 week or 2 weeks. But it just really depends on where the department and districts decide to place the testing window. And then it may depend on a number of, like, for instance, how many constructed items is included in the new assessment, because we haven't actually built this assessment yet. So it's going to depend on a lot of different factors. But our goal has always, and particularly with a test that's not part of our accountability system, that we get results back as quickly as possible. And we've built this test to be more instructionally based for teachers and students. And so we think that we can deliver on that. I just can't give you an exact time frame.
Representative Wardlaw, would you care to incorporate in your amendment the word life in place of biology, will make it consistent with the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Good. And then you have a question, I believe.
Yeah. I always like to get my test back the next day, 2 days at the most. There's a way to make it come back the next day. They'll figure it out. You may not like the way, but they'll get it done.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wardlaw, we always want to get results back quicker, and actually testing companies can do that if you pony up the money.
It won't cost you a dime.
Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're on the amendment at this point, members.
Commissioner, will you walk through for us then how this amendment relates to what is the new language on lines 118 and 119? Because I think, I'm not sure I'm following this exactly.
And while you do that, perhaps, let me ask Ms. Larson to do some further corrections to the amendment.
Okay.
We're working off of an oral amendment at this point. Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. On the House File 3403, page 1, line 18, delete and. On page 1, line 19, delete assessment and insert assessments. And on page 1, line 20, after the period, insert each assessment given in the grades 10 through 12 span must be administered at the end of the course for which science standards instruction is completed in each content area of earth and space, comma, life, comma, and physical science.
No
idea. I thought that myself. Representative Wormhole, that's your amendment then.
That's what the chair
said. Any further discussion on the amendment? All in favor? Representative Spoken.
I just keep looking at this and pondering. My question, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner, is with this test, and it's technologically based, it would be on the computer, it would then tie up the computer lab for three times during the school year for the assessment, as opposed to one time with a more comprehensive broad-based assessment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slocum, that's correct, but we're trying to balance the issue of testing students on subject matters they took, you know, years prior to the test, and then it's not as valuable to teachers. For instance, the physical science teacher taught the course and the student took it 2 years later, and how valuable is the data anymore to that physical science teacher? So it will involve more use of computer labs, but we're also trying to balance the, let's have data that can be effectively used in the classroom in a timely manner.
Thank you.
All right, members, all in favor of the Wardlaw amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Welty, I love your tactic. We got the mysterious amendment on. That's a, well, I'm going to take notes on how to do that.
Members, I appreciate your wisdom on the amendment, and I believe that this is a very good piece of legislation that needs to move forward so that what we're assessing reflects what the students are learning and assessing it in a timely manner.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill? If not, Representative Welty renews his motion. House File 3403 as amended. Be recommended to pass. Referred to Finance Committee with a recommendation to be referred to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Welty. Thank you, Mr. Gordon, Mr. Olson. And now we have Representative Dabney, House File 3793. Representative Dabney moves that House File 3793 be recommended to pass. And Representative Dabney, I believe this is going to public safety. Is that?
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding as well.
Okay.
I believe because of the Tennyson warning issues related to this legislation.
And I believe in the Senate, I think they took that route as well. Was that?
I'm sorry.
I think they might have taken that route as well over in the Senate. Very well. The motion is before us. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, there's aspects of this bill that are quite involved, technical, and legalistic. In your packets, I believe you've been provided, or are being provided by the page at this time, an opinion by the Commissioner of the Department of Administration as it relates to student discipline and the Tennyson warning and the Minnesota High School League. What I will tell you very simply is that legalities aside, what this is about is right-sizing the relationship between students and the adults in their lives in Minnesota schools. When I'm in my classroom as a teacher, in the hall on hall duty, or outside on bus duty, yes, I'm an authority figure, and yes, I have authority to discipline students. But the right size of that relationship is also about being, hopefully, a warm and positive adult in a student's life who is not merely an authority figure, but a nurturer and someone who teaches not just geography, but deeper issues of behavior and values and respect. And this bill, at its core, is about that relationship. Mr. Chair, I have with me today Mr. Roger Aronson. Thank you, Mr. Aronson. There is an amendment in members' packets that I would like to move at this time, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dabney moves the H3793A1 amendment. In fact, you can tell us quickly what that is.
It's largely technical. It merely changes that districts, instead of having a requirement, they communicate to students an expectation on behavior. I think it's hard to require. It's better to expect, and you get what you expect. And the second line, page 2, line 4, I believe, is a more of a technical restatement from Ms. Larson. If she disagrees, I certainly would welcome that correction.
I see Ms. Larson nodding her head enthusiastically, yes. So you got it right. You're passing the Larson test here, Representative Davis.
That's a high standard.
That is a very high standard. Members, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Again, then, Mr. Chair, if I may, Mr. Roger Aronson is here with me today, representing both the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals and the Minnesota High School League.
Welcome, Mr. Aronson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Roger Aronson. I'm going to go through this quickly, and we appreciate taking the committee's time on Friday afternoon. Just as a little bit of background, this issue arose a year ago. We did form a coalition of groups to work on this. In the interim, it came up late in last session. We didn't think there was time enough to fix it. And lawyers from the School Board Association, from the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, representatives as well, Education Minnesota, the School Principals Association, and other interested groups worked on this. This is a very important bill to us, and we're very thankful to have Representative Dabney handle it, notwithstanding that the physical piece of it, its scope, is two sentences. Buried in the Government Data Practices Act is a requirement that any time a governmental entity seeks confidential information from an individual, that you have to give this five-statement warning. It's named after a former state senator. It's one of the few pieces of legislation where we have a senator's name actually in the head note in Minnesota Statute 1304. What happens with this is, in any circumstances, if the Revenue Department calls you in and wants to ask you about your tax return, they have to tell you whether or not you have to give them that information, what they're going to do to you when you give them that information, what they'll do to you if you don't give it, and then who they're going to share that with. In particular circumstances where government entities seek information these days, you can see where this would be very important. If some department, agency, or transit, or whomever it might be, was asking you for your Social Security number, you would want to know whether or not you had to do that, and who they would be sharing it with. Unfortunately, the rule is so broad that it percolates down into school. 1304 simply says anytime the government asks anybody for information, this rule applies. We always thought, you know, technically it might end up applying to us in schools, but we didn't worry about it very much. Last year, an incident arose out of Shakopee where the student consumed alcohol in violation of the high school league rules. The student would admitted to consuming the alcohol, would have had to serve a violation as a result of this, had signed the high school league statements, in which I provided you a copy of this. That's this document, and if you look into the third page of that, it talks about the athletic eligibility statement. And students are fully advised of this. They agree you see where there's a student code of responsibilities in there. Students are going to do these things. Every student that participates in extracurricular activities in Minnesota annually signs one of these. When the principals talk to the student in this instance, they talked about several cases. The student admitted to doing the alcohol. Later, we ended up with litigation. And we ended up with lawyers saying, well, notwithstanding that the form was signed, Minnesota Statutes 1304 would require in any setting with a student that you also give them a Tennyson warning. That doesn't work for us overall. And as I was preparing some thoughts for you, the reason Education Minnesota had an interest in this is this technically percolates down into the classroom. I made a list of sample questions for you today that would have to be, if we technically applied this, would have to be preceded by a Tennyson warning. What is your name? What were you doing in the hallway? Were you drinking beer at the party? Where is your homework? Who threw the meatball in the lunchroom? Which car is yours? Who else was involved in the fight? And several, you know, all of you have been to school. Several of you have teachers, several of you have administrators on the committee here. You know what we're talking about. We have Principal Murphy, who is the principal in Shakopee, came down to spend the time with here today, not so much to testify, but just to let you know that this really is an important issue for us. We'd like to be exempt from giving this in classrooms and in typical disciplinary situations. There is one exception, and that's contained in the statute, and that's in the case of expulsion. And in the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act, there's a technical provision that says students can't be compelled to testify against themselves in expulsion. So it makes sense that we would be saying to them, you don't have to talk to us for giving us this information in the matter that leads up to expulsion. This isn't to change anything with regard to health information. If we're soliciting health information from students, that would still require a Tennyson warning. Any testing information, other data, those kinds of things, or anything relating to their parents. And we've worked with staff on that, and to cure any potential problems on that, that's what the amendment is that Representative Dabney offered us. The bill is supported by the Minnesota School Boards Association. It is supported by the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, as well as both of the school principal organizations as well. It seems like a small thing, and I just want to say to the committee, I was visiting with Representative Dabney about this, and one of the things that you folks do is sometimes you can do small things that help us very much, and this is one of those cases. We have special relationships with kids, just as Representative Dabney referenced here. We still are governed by all of the confidentiality requirements of teacher and principal's licenses, of the Government Data Practices Act. We have to give students notice of all of the rules. They have to be in writing. They have to be clear and definite. We think we do a real good job. We think, frankly, this practice will probably legalize, this bill will probably legalize what generally the practice is in schools now. Mr. Chairman, members, I'd answer any questions that you might have.
Before you do, let me just ask if there's anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill. Very well. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Arnson, do you think, though, that replacing a requirement with an expectation isn't also still going to be open to lawsuits?
Mr. Arnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I don't think so. There are other statutes that actually direct schools to adopt a uniform set of rules to govern the conduct of students and to provide them with notice of what they need to conform their behavior to. I mean, that's pretty almost a verbatim out of the statute. The idea was we didn't want this to seem overly heavy-handed and this was to soften it that much. And frankly, most of discipline, and I represent 1,200 secondary principals and 700 elementary principals, and we do a lot of training with people, and most of discipline isn't about punishing children. It's about teaching them things. I mean, I know that might sound kind I don't know what to say, but I mean, I am a lawyer. Coming from a lawyer, it sounds a little cheesy, but it is true. It's what these folks are trying to do. It's not a criminal system. It's a learning system. So the word expectation in there, we like that better, and the author said that's the word he liked, and that's why that's in there, too.
Are there any other questions? Professor Warble.
President, when I'm in the lunchroom and I want to ask a kid who threw the tray on the floor, who squashed the banana on the rug, who whatever, I have to say you don't have to answer this before I say who did that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wardlow, that's the biggest terror about the application of this opinion that we have, because we really think the first time you say to kids, you don't have to tell me what you were doing, they'll learn.
Right? Well, I think adults are far smarter than young teenagers, don't you think? Any other questions or comments? I suspect in public safety you'll be dissecting some of the finer language, including perhaps that issue that Representative Erickson raised about expectation versus requirement. If not, members, Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 3793 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And Representative Dabney, if this is successful, we'll find a way to create the Dabney provision similar to the Tennyson. And future generations will be talking about the Dabney provision.
Perhaps focus more on expectations.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your flexibility today.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Flails. Representative Flails moves House File 3633 be recommended to pass and refer to Finance Committee with a recommendation that it move on to the K-12 Finance Committee. Representative Boyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, today this particular bill is one that's very similar to the one that we passed unanimously last year. It directs the State Board of School Administrators and the State Board of Teaching to provide opportunities for educators to acquire competency in working with...
Mr. Chair, may I just interrupt you? You've got a lead-off, is that correct?
Oh, yes, sir.
Perhaps we should do that, and then your comments, I think, will fit the lead-off language here.
Sure.
Representative Quayle moves the Amendment 8633DE1, the lead-off amendment, and that'll put the bill in the shape that you wish it to be before us today. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Quayle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I was saying, this directs the State Board of School Administrators and the State Board of Teaching to provide opportunities for educators to acquire competency in working with gifted and talented services, programs, and students. It also directs the Administrators Academy to provide opportunities for administrators to acquire competency in administering gifted and talented services. Basically, what I'd like you to know is that after we discussed this last spring, the stakeholders in gifted and talented education came together and felt like there was a great deal more work that we needed to do in describing what those competencies are that we need for administrators to have, as well as those who are wanting to work with gifted and talented students in the classroom. So we have worked very, very hard, and this has been months long of discussions, committee meetings, working together with the various stakeholders. And the most recent incarnation, the lead-all amendment that we have, was really a result of a meeting this week with the Board of Teaching, who felt that the original bill that we had here was just too prescriptive, that it required a lot of CEUs, a lot of hours that needed to be written into statutes, and they were uncomfortable with that. So, with that said, it is my opinion that the delete all amendment does move us forward. It's not everything that all the stakeholders want, but it does move us forward to making gifted and talented identification of students. There's so many people coughing.
Oh, no.
And now I join the ranks. Oh, my goodness.
Have a long weekend to work.
Oh, my goodness. But this is a step forward, and I am passionate about gifted and talented education. Working with many gifted and talented students, as I have over the years, I realize that sometimes we are in a battle providing the kind of education and challenges that these young people need. The kinds of students that we see in gifted and talented are sometimes what's called the twice exceptional students. These are the students that may have a special education need plus are profoundly gifted. The administrators and the teachers who are not trained in being able to identify these kinds of students and be able to provide the necessary steps that they can have for a very enriching educational opportunity. If our professionals are missing the training that they need to be able to do that identifying, then I think these students are being shortchanged. So next to me is Tina Armstrong. She is a parent, but she's also a member of the Minnesota Council of Gifted and Talented, and she is going to make a brief statement.
Thank you, Representative Wells. Ms. Armstrong, welcome.
Welcome, Mr. Chair. I'm sitting here after working on this for many months, and when we approached this year, we were looking for a first step, and this bill is definitely a first step towards getting gifted ed training into all of our teachers and all of our administrators, we hope someday. It's hard for Minnesota Council for Gifted and Talented because we have started working on this in 1981. We've been on task forces. We've attempted to go through the rulemaking process. This is our second year with it right now, trying to go at this legislatively. And this year we really tried to spend months sitting down with the universities. We sat down with the Board of Teaching, Board of School Administrators, the principals associations, and we really tried to get a large number of a broad spectrum of people to understand, you know, a big plan for what we're looking for gifted. We were hoping to see continuing education requirements. We were hoping to see pre-service requirements that were requiring teachers to demonstrate competency on the pre-service level as opposed to, you know, having opportunities within the program if they chose to elect that to get some pre-service training. So this is going to be one of those things where you guys are going to be seeing us for a number of years. It's something I'm passionate about. Minnesota Council for Gifted and Talented, we're an advocacy, we're an education organization. We're teaching parents, we're largely parents, and we're teaching parents how to advocate for their 80,000 kids. And, I've sat there as the chair of, I've sat there as a parent with my student being learning weeks later that he had been put out in the hall with a book for hours a day because the teacher didn't know what else to do with him. I've had my kid be told that, well, we know you know that material anyway, but here, spend all your time doing this. It wouldn't be fair to everybody else if you didn't have to complete all these worksheets also. And so it's those types of things, those types of experiences that the parents sometimes really know more about gifted eds than some of their administrators, since there is not a requirement out there. But I am thankful for a first step and knowing that there are more to come on this, and we're willing to approach it from a legislative, a rules standpoint, and it's something we're going to fight for a long time.
I also need to say that Karen Ballmer from the Board of Teaching has been very instrumental in helping with this. She is not able to be here this afternoon because of conflicts, and she has been so wonderful in working with us on this. But the Board of Teaching has some very strong opinions about not being as prescriptive as the bill that this amendment replaces. Ms. Larson has also been very involved in helping with this. Is there something that perhaps from Ms. Ballmer's point of view that you...
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, members, Karen Ballmer, as Representative Swales indicates, Karen Ballmer, who is the Executive Director of the Board of Teaching, and Roger Aronson, who works with the school administrators, and I sat down after several meetings with advocates of the gifted and talented and tried to represent the interests or the intent of all of these different groups in preparing legislation that represents the first step on behalf of Representative Swales.
Thank you.
Mr.
Chair, I'd like Mr. Aronson to also make a statement since he's been so involved in this as well.
Mr. Chair, members, I think Council has appropriately laid out the work that's happened on this. The initial draft was of significant concern to the administrative community and the teaching community as well. Ms. Ballmer from the Board of Teaching was very helpful in structuring this. We thought it has a very nice fit in the new draft because it involves the Principals Academy in it as well, which we've talked to the Finance Division about already. Representative Greiling has been very supportive of that program, and we think the Gifted and Talented training would be a good fit in there, and we've talked to the folks at the Academy. They think that's a good idea as well. So we're very supportive of the draft in this particular fashion. I might have to add as well that Representative Swale teaches with my sister, who told me also that I was for this. So,
but I learned at age 5 to listen to my sister. And, I was the oldest in the family, but she was the one who was in charge.
Yeah.
I also would like to say Dr. Judith Lamp was very involved in this, and her organization was in the midst last summer of writing competencies for it's the Board of Administrators. And because they knew of the concerns from the gifted and talented community, and they were already in the midst of rewriting their list of competencies, they did include some of the provisions that are in this bill into their competencies, and so they are already doing this as a matter of course. So I would urge members to please support this bill. We continue to talk about raising the bar, raising the level of rigor, providing opportunities for our students to truly use their innate abilities to create a stronger workforce in the future. By challenging our gifted and talented students, I do believe that we are well on our way to providing the kind of education that all of us hope to be providing here in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Swales. Representative
Erickson
has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Swales, for the delete all. I can certainly support this bill now that you have changed some of the language. And, you know, this is just very much needed. However, my concern always is with the teacher prep program. Will they actually follow through now, because they have the expertise to provide this kind of training for both administrators and for teachers? So what I found in my career was sometimes it was better to just find a really good workshop that taught strategies for teaching gifted and talented and taught more about understanding their needs. Then, you know, maybe some college program would, because college programs have to cover so much. But, you know, I appreciate your work with Ms. Ballmer, and you have the periodic review, and, you know, there always is a review anyway of teacher prep programs for the Board of Teaching. So I'm hoping this will work out really well and serve our gifted and talented in a better way. But I'll be kind of checking on those colleges to see if they're doing the job. So thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Is anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Very well.
Representative Swales, I want to thank you for the hard work you've put into this work. You were engaging a number of interests and individuals, and I think you struck a very good balance here. It's a testament to your fine and hard work, and I think that this community is well represented by your efforts both last year and this year. So I just wanted to acknowledge that. All right, very well. Members, Representative Swales removes the motion that House File 3633, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Finance Committee for a recommendation to move on to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Wales. Members, our final bill is House File 3316, which is my bill. And I just want to let you know what we're going to do here. We are scheduled to adjourn at 3 o'clock. We're not going to be able to do that and hear this bill. And so it's going to be the chair's intention here not to go beyond 3:30 here. So we're going to have to move pretty big. There's a number of provisions in this bill. I also want to inform the members we're not going to be voting on House File 3316 this afternoon, but don't all make your way to the door because of that, please. it is my intention to lay this over. We will take this up on Tuesday. At which point I'll be offering some further amendments to House File 3316. There is, however, a corrective amendment that the department has produced that we do want to move today so that the bill that is in the shape that the department wants it to be before us. So with that, members, I'm going to move House File 3316 be recommended to pass. And then I'm going to move. Where's my mouse? I'm going to move the AO81254 amendment, which then puts the bill in the form that the department wishes it to be before us.
So, members, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is amended. It's before us. And so our goal here, if we can do it under 35 minutes, that's wonderful, but we'll see. Our goal here is to have a walkthrough of the bill and for us to be able to engage with the department for clarifying what they're proposing in this in this bill. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our commissioner to lead us in the effort of doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will be very, very brief, and then I'll turn it over to Dr. Melcher and Deputy Commissioner Anderson. The bill has mainly about four parts. You're going to be looking at some of the technical financial fixes that we have in the bill that address some either obsolete language or changes that maybe didn't get incorporated into the biennial budget changes that we had last year. We have some language in regard to charter schools, which we think clarify some of the statutes in charter schools that we've had questions about and we think that they need to be changed. We also have some testing provisions that just clarify the new grad program that is part of our new requirements for some clarification there. Then we also have just some other kinds of things. One of the others is actually going to be moved out of our bill today. It's a data sharing agreement. We'll talk a little bit about that. Representative Mariani will be carrying that in another bill because we don't need to have this bill going to data practices and judiciary, and so that'll be taken care of in a different manner. So we have a few other little miscellaneous things, and we'll try to go over those as quickly as we possibly can.
Wonderful. And members, but I'm going to ask you to certainly feel free to interrupt if there's clarifying points as we walk through the bill, because there are a number of provisions here, so waiting until the end kind of doesn't make sense. So, Mr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Article 1, Section 1 is amending the section of law dealing with the records that are kept by the school board clerk to delete an obsolete reference to a report on the condition and value of school property and to align the dates by which the clerk reports information on school district finances and property taxes to conform with other statutes. It's a technical change.
And Mr. Melcher, because I marked up the first the original bill, I may ask some questions that are already addressed by the amendments. I apologize ahead for that, but I may just go ahead and do those and just let me know. You know, those are in the amendments. In this first section, as far as the technical, there is striking the word management in following the audit report. And these are for charter schools, I believe. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's later in the.
Did I skip ahead? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay. But that deals with charter schools. It's later in Article 1.
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were done with Article
1. Oh, no. I was just Article 1, Section 1.
Wishful thinking.
Mr. Chairman and members, Article 1, Section 2 is moving the date by which the department publishes the consolidated school district financial report from January 15th to February 15th in order to allow the department to publish the final data the first time rather than publishing a preliminary report just after the due date and then publishing a revised report, which creates some confusion. Article 1, Sections 3, 4, and 5 are providing technical corrections, deleting obsolete language relating to statutory operating debt that goes back to 1977. Again, technical changes. Article 1, Section 6 is a date change. It would allow the department to publish a report on statutory operating debt on February 15th instead of January 1st. This would allow us to produce a more complete report. January 1st is the day after the reports are due, and we've had to exclude some districts from the report in the past, and this would allow us to do a more comprehensive report. Article 1, Section 7 is the one dealing with the charter school finances. I believe Deputy Commissioner Anderson is going to speak to that.
Deputy Commissioner.
That's mine. Article 1, Section 7 is dealing with the the audit report, and this is striking a reference to the management letter, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for this is that the findings of material weakness are actually contained in the audit report itself and not in the management letter. So this is conforming the statute to the way that the school district actually do the audits.
Thank you, Mr. Melton. I really wanted to be clear about that because as a former Representative Friedman remembers, when we put this into statute, we were trying to respond to some unfortunate circumstances involving charter schools. I didn't want anyone to read that we were trying to water any of that, those efforts down in terms of holding those schools financially accountable.
Article 1, Section 8 is clarifying that the federal, state, and local zoning, health, and safety and fire code that applies to school districts also applies to charter schools. Again, it's a clarification.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chaz Anderson, Deputy Education Commissioner. This one you'll have to refer back to the amendment that was adopted earlier. Section 9, the new language that's on your bill actually was deleted by the amendment that was adopted. Going to page 6.
I think it's a very good amendment, by the way. Thank you.
Going to page 6, line 5, the language that's stricken in the bill was actually reinstated by the amendment that was adopted. Lines 6 and 7 on page 6, that new language on those lines was deleted by the amendment that was adopted. Line 18, the new language on the bill was deleted by the amendment that was adopted. Lines 20 through 22 is new language that still exists. This is allowing when there's a change of sponsor for a charter school, that when the commissioner considers that granting the change of sponsor, that she may consider any outstanding issues that charter school had with her previous sponsor when considering the change of sponsor.
And Assistant Commissioner, we may want to visit and talk about that a little bit in terms of making sure we're not, I know it's not your intent, but making sure we're not using vague language here in terms of, you know, what does it mean to address, and what are, you know, what's the scope of outstanding issues, but we'll have time to have that conversation.
Mr. Chair, on line 34, the amendment adopted actually deleted the new language.
And so, Assistant Commissioner, currently the practice would be that any such appeals are done in district court? Is that, if it gets to that level, is that the...
No, actually, what we're trying to do in this language is right now, if a sponsor terminated a contract with a charter school, that charter school, if the school board sponsored the charter school, would have the ability to go to the commissioner and appeal the decision directly to the commissioner. However, if the sponsor was a higher education institution or a nonprofit, they would not have that ability. And what we've had in recent experiences of disputes between sponsors and charters is that in this case, because it's a decision of the commissioner, it must go to the Court of Appeals under case law by Rita Certiorari. But unfortunately, because higher ed and nonprofits are not written in the statute, then we've kind of gone back and forth from district court to the Court of Appeals, which is a very different experience, as you can imagine. And so what we were trying to do with this new language is say, it doesn't matter who the sponsor is, you can appeal to the commissioner, and then any decision she makes, which is consistent to case law, is to go to the Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming then that this amendment was asked for or at least approved by the charter school groups, and are they okay with what's left then?
Mr. Chair, we had discussions about the language with the charter school organization, and they are fine with the amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the clarification, Representative Grantley. Proceed, please.
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher. Article 1, Section 10 is correcting for the absence of an effective date in the QCOMP funding change that was made in the 2007 legislative session. The legislative tracking and the intent was that the change from the state funding 73.1% of the cost to 65% of the cost, that take effect in fiscal year 2010. We've been implementing the law that way based on a letter that we received from the chair. This is going back and clarifying the statute to reflect the intent from last year.
Very well.
Article 1, Section 11 deals with the eligibility for the building lease levy for desegregation districts. and this is updating the language to reflect the current desegregation rule and the current integration law. There's no change in policy. These are technical corrections.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melcher, when it says or erase, does this in any way affect charter schools that are racially isolated or is it just other schools?
Mr. Melcher.
No, this is just school districts.
Okay.
And Dr. Melcher, the references here are to the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth school districts?
The references to clause 1, 2, and 3 are to the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth school districts. The references to clause 4 and 5 below are to other school districts that are required to file a desegregation plan. And there are some different standards here that apply. The other districts are required to show the relationship between the building lease and the desegregation plan, and Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth are not required to show that, and that's why they're in two separate portions of the sentence. Sections 12 and 13 of Article 1 are a technical change that eliminate a reference to a consolidated general education levy that was inadvertently included in the 2007 bill. The language was taken from the Senate bill, which had included a consolidated general education levy. That levy was not actually approved, and so this is basically eliminating an incorrect reference to a provision in law that doesn't exist.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, going to Article 2, as the Commissioner mentioned, Section 1 has been deleted from the bill with the adoption of the amendment. This is the data sharing agreement that's traveling in a separate bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Bolton, Minnesota Department.
I'm sorry, your last name?
Tom Bolton, Minnesota Department of Education.
Bolton. Thank you.
Article 2, Section 2, we seek some clarification of the language regarding a graduation test in keeping with the legislation passed last year with regard to the grad test. Article 2, Section 3. Language is being deleted in order to be able to make clear that students who have cognitive disabilities are required to be assessed under the state assessment in keeping with both NCLB and the IDEA.
And Mr. Boltman, we're referencing federal law on line, I think it's line 0.18, as described under federal law. Is that typical for us to do, to just reference federal law in terms of...
Mr. Chair.
Assistant Commissioner.
If you look at the paragraph, I think we're just trying to be consistent with the beginning of the paragraph with current law, says for the purposes of applicable federal law. So I think that you could probably place a period after the word plans, and it would mean the same thing.
Thank you.
In Article 2, Section 4, the language is being clarified as to when the statewide assessments will be aligned to the new state standards. That is in both lines 13 on page 14, as well as down in line 30 as well.
So this basically allows us to align with our current periods of review. Is that
that's
a review of the standards?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Mr. Chair, Section 5, this deletes language that places a cap on how many exam fees that the state can reimburse for students taking the CLEP exam. The language proposed striking that cap and allowing more flexibility to spend those state funds.
So, Assistant Commissioner, essentially there would be no limit then?
Mr. Chair, the limit would be through the capped appropriation, which is similar to what we have in AP and IB. If there is more demand for the exams, then we actually prorate what we pay on each exam. And so this is consistent to how we treat AP and IB exams.
Okay. Thank you.
Section 6 relates to the gifted and talented provision. The department took one recommendation of the gifted and talented committee to which added on line 19 an identification appeals process. And this allows, if a parent believes that their child should be in the gifted program, they can file an appeal to the school board for consideration.
In Article 7, language is being added to allow the Minnesota Department of Education the ability to conduct field tests on national sampling tests, and school districts would be required to participate unless they can indicate that it would place an undue hardship on them to do so.
And you had an opportunity to speak with different districts about whether or not they might see this as overly onerous or overly vague or overly something. Believe me, I'm going to get the question, so I'm asking you guys.
Mr. Chair and members, we have to participate, as you know, in the NAEP test. That's the Nation's school report card, if you will. We also, last year, were required to administer the TIM. And all of these testing processes require participation, and they require a sampling. And so they have to select based on, you know, demographics and other criteria school districts to meet their testing, you know, process. And so in doing that, it's sometimes difficult. School districts say, no, we're not going to participate. We don't feel like participating. And then it becomes more and more difficult then to fulfill the requirements and get an accurate sampling. And so I personally literally spent 40 hours calling different school districts. I actually clocked my time to ask, you know, districts to participate when other districts said, no, we weren't going to do it. Or I called back and I pleaded and begged, you know, because this was
something. I thought it was supposed to be fun to be Commissioner of Education.
Well, I got a chance to talk with a lot of different
people. There you go.
It just would be clear. And then if there was a hardship situation, then, you know, absolutely, you know, we would respect that. When we have these requirements, either from the state or from the federal government to participate in these things, it becomes very difficult then if we don't have that requirement in place.
Thank you. Please.
Section 8, actually on the top of page 19, we are clarifying some language regarding the science assessment. Currently, the language is indicating that ninth grade students are not allowed to take the high school test. We'd like to change that language so that grade 9 is included in the high school life science assessment, if that's the grade in which the students had taken life sciences in their high school.
Mr. Chair, Section 9 deletes language on page 20. This is statutory language requires collection of data we do not and cannot collect. Things such as number of single-parent families, parents' level of education, parents' income, outcomes, and we collect it in another way. For instance, parental income, we'll collect that through our free and reduced lunch counts, which is in another part of the statute. And so we're seeking to delete this language we believe is obsolete in light of how we do our data and reporting.
Since the commission, I just want to be clear, because not having any of the much of the context, when I look at the language, demographic factors, and they explain what some of those are, those seem like valuable pieces of information, and whether we can collect it or not is another issue. But what you're saying is that, if I heard you right, that you're finding different ways to be able to collect that, or are we just sort of backing off completely from being able to collect that and factor it into these purposes?
Mr. Chair, basically, we really can't collect some of this data, or we collect it as part of a different data collection. For instance, parental income level, you know, we generally collect that as free and reduced lunch information, so we know what students of poverty, and we acknowledge the impact based on the testing results we give. We break that out into subgroups. But we really cannot and would not, in the state of privacy concerns about collecting parents' level of education, whether in the number of single-parent families, We acknowledge probably all of these things have an impact on student achievement, but we just have no real way of collecting the data. And as I said, we report subgroups now, which includes free and reduced lunch. And so we're just seeking to delete the language because as time has gone on, we report this in a different way.
Okay. Afterwards, we can spend a little bit more time talking about this, right? Can better understand that. I mean, I place a really high value on this type of information. I suspect you do too, but I just want to make sure that we're not backing away from a state commitment to be able to factor those issues in. Let me back up, and then Representative Dietrich has a question. And I apologize. I want to back up to the previous Section 8. And it was the very last new language, which is on line 19.30, I think. I'm working off of another version. Is it 19.30? Yeah. Yeah, the sub-S.
Mr. Chair, I think I jumped in front of Mr. Boltman on this and went to Section 9. Line 19 requires that a school or district or charter school place the student's assessment score for grade 9, grade 10, and grade 11 on the student's high school transcript. This is a proposal we brought back from last year. It's really an attempt to try to get students to take the high school NCA assessments more seriously.
So this, okay. We discussed this last year, if I remember right. Yes, we had quite an interesting. Okay. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to go back to page 16, section 7, subdivision 1, where you you allow for the exemptions for the field-tested national test or national sampling. And when I have heard, and I'm speaking specifically to the NAEP test, when I hear descriptions of the NAEP, I remember the word random sampling is the means that we use to get that, the results of that test. And so if there are exemptions for undue hardship, is that truly then a random sample, and is that a bad test for our state as to how we are doing in science education?
Mr. Chair, that's a really good question. I learned a lot through the TIMS process, how this random sampling works, as I know the commissioner does too. And that is, they'll select groups of three schools that fit the cell size or whatever what they need in different cells. And so if school one can't do it, the hardship, you fall to school two and then to school three. And there's several different cells, and that's part of the random sampler that WESTAT does. And that's how we work it. So it's not just if we give that school an exemption, then we still have backup schools that meet the similar demographics, then that we can go to.
Okay, so it is still valid, even though we include this exception for it. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, as long as we get a school from each cell, like they call it cells.
Okay.
And they usually give you at least three options.
Thank you.
Very well. We're 12 minutes away from my self-imposed deadline here. So.
Mr. Chair, Section 10 on page 20 comes from the Board of Teaching. This is allowing the teacher who has been appointed to the board and should retire during the his or her term that they be allowed to carry out that entire appointment even as a retired. As you know, the terms are 4 years. Again, Section 11. This is basically not allowing a retired teacher to be appointed to a position that they're currently retired. So this allows basically the teacher who is retired during the term to serve out the term.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pat King, Minnesota Department of Education.
Welcome, Ms. King.
Director of School Improvement, and the staff development changes that we're proposing lead us to assist us in moving beyond just random staff development to a more of a systematic approach of allowing teachers to have professional development during the school day, job-embedded professional development. Student achievement and teacher effectiveness increase when schools develop and implement staff development plans that are focused on students. The language tightens the alignment between school improvement efforts, staff development, to improve teacher instructional practices for increasing student learning.
Go through the change.
Okay. Line 21.3 We would like to include teacher training plans so that it's more inclusive rather than just using this language staff development. 2111, making sure that the plans that schools are developing, schools and districts are developing, is really aligned with the current educational improvement plan that's currently in legislation. Looking beyond research-based, using scientifically-based research, which is a term that's commonly used. Line 21.17, this is an opportunity for input and dialogue among teachers. One thing that we do hear a lot as we're out providing professional development is that teachers regularly don't have time and opportunities to talk to one another during the school day and reflect on their practice. That line 21.19, again, the same thing. 21.23, job and integrated professional development. Part of this language is also helping us align the professional development 2% set aside between for those districts that are currently in QCOMP and the regular staff development. There seems to be a disconnect between the two pieces of legislation, so we're really trying to look at the educational improvement plan piece, QCOMP piece, and staff development to make more of an alignment so it's easier for districts to understand how all of this really fit together. Again, it's during the teacher contract days, a lot of times our schools will have an opportunity to send one or two teachers off to a training. They come back from the training and they really don't have a lot of time sometimes to be able to connect with one another. 2130, this is helping us to align professional development again, or strengthen the alignment for those schools and districts that are currently participating in QCOMP programs.
We have a couple of questions on question 12. Representative Benson and Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Real quick on 2114, where you have scientifically based research, could I interpret that to mean peer review?
Could be.
Yes, it should be, should it not?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it would be peer reviewed, not just. Because there's a lot of research and education which is adding anecdotal and so forth, mm-hmm. you know. So I'm hoping it's peer reviewed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative, you may consider an amendment at some point, unless that term is inclusive of it. I had been intermingling research-based and scientific, and had not, with other notions, and had not thought about scientifically-based research. So I think I'm picking up the distinctions, and I think it is an important distinction along how you're vetting out here. I'm sorry, I thought we had finished section 12, but nonetheless, let's see there for the next question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. King, subdivision 1A, these effective staff development activities then become a mandate?
2110
and the following.
It's not a mandate. It's really looking at aligning the school plans that districts and schools and districts are putting together. Really what we've been asked for over and over again is assistance in the area of helping the teachers and schools align their staff development plans with current data from their student data, and helping take that information and align it with the learning goal so that it's directly connected from the teacher to the student in the classroom and back again.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Ms. Pink, I understand that, but this, if this is enacted into law, this will say that staff development activities must, and then clause 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, et cetera. They must do these things. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I will add that on agreement with the union, the whole staff development set aside and provision can be waived if the union and district agree to that. And that does happen, has happened in the past. So both sides agree they can mutually waive this.
Helpful. Representative Lane.
Just a quick comment. We kind of put words in your mouth when you change from research-based to scientifically-based research. Could you just clarify why you wanted that change?
Ms. King? Or Assistant Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Representative Benson sort of hit on that. There's a difference between just general research that a lot of people do in college and work and such, and then there's scientifically based research, which actually you must have the specific steps you must take in order to have your work be called scientifically based research, and one of them is having outside evaluators or having it be peer reviewed, as Representative Benson said. Mm-hmm. And so this is this has been the movement across states and national organizations to try to move away from research that's just research collected and data collected, and here it is, to more scientifically based research that where they've had to show controls versus use of this practice and how it impacts student achievement and have it peer reviewed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, would you accept a friendly amendment on the word scientifically and substitute the word peer review? And would the
Let me suggest because we're going to be back to the thing.
Okay.
It'll give you some time for them to think about it and then perhaps
to
work out some language. So, very well.
Okay. 22.6, based on student achievement and student learning goals. I hit on that a little bit, but again, it's bringing the staff development for the teachers in the classroom to directly connect with the needs of their students. 22.11, looking at leading to increased student achievement. A lot of this language that we've wanted to make amendments to really is increasing. It's all about connecting that teacher directly to the class, to the student. 22.16, we're back on scientifically based research. We'll come back to that again. On 22.24, we're looking at teachers in their first 5 years of teaching. We find it to be very important, and research supports that you really need to connect and support the teachers that are new in the classroom, to support them to continue to come back and stay with us and bring them up to where they need. So it's the mentoring piece that we have. 22.30, we would like to have a date, or we are asking to have a date change to October 1 to allow us additional time for the staff development report. And what we're also finding on the school district end is that they'd really like to get their last year's pieces cleaned up, so they'd like to have an earlier date for submission. And
that finishes out question 12.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll just add on the amendment. We just made a technical change on line 14 and 16 to add a hyphen between scientifically and based. And then on line 18, this came from a Senate request when the bill was heard in the Senate, and that is on line 18, adding English language learners after at-risk children, as to looking at effectively meeting the needs of a diverse student population.
Thank you.
Okay, 20 on under staff development revenue, removing in-service and just leaving that open. In-service tends to lead to a one-day type training. So, and primary purpose of creating and implementing school and district site staff development plans, really focusing on what the primary purpose of using the revenue is for, and then using funds to support the plan, the planning of the, or developing the plan. And curriculum, moving up to the curriculum and development piece, looking at if you really have limited resources to help teachers be more effective in the classroom, we really would like the language to focus on helping those teachers and ensuring that we're focusing on ongoing job-embedded professional development. And
so, again, by striking in service, you gave me a definition of in-service as, I think, as sort of a one-day kind of thing, but I hear in-service, I hear like a particular approach to, you know, providing, in this case, a development opportunity during a certain period of time. Are we getting away from that? If you can help me just be clear about what it
sure.
is we're...
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, what we're looking at here is, as the professional development that is designed in a school or a district, it can be sometimes it is a one-day workshop, but it's really about a much broader strategy that's ongoing throughout the year, and then being able to take the information or the training and come back to your school or your district and work with your teachers to review what you've learned, to practice what you've learned, to have those conversations, collegial conversations. So again, it could be a one-day workshop, but we would hope that it would be part of a much broader strategy. For instance, if you sent a teacher off for training on something like reading recovery, you wouldn't want that teacher to come back to the classroom and only sit in their classroom and think about it. You want them to share that information and be able to dialogue with others in the school about it, or something on coaching or mentoring or professional learning community.
And Ms. King, on line 23, the cost of substitute teachers, why are we striking that? It seems to me that'd be an important thing in any kind of a staff development opportunity during teaching hours.
Mr. Chair, I think what the intention of the language is actually to give the district more flexibility. And it, in the language it said, you know, including all these things you can use for reimbursement. Instead, we say funds may be used to support plans for challenging instructional activities and experiences under 2022A.60. And if they need substitute teachers to meet that requirement, that's up to the district to make
so
that.
So this isn't meant to be prescriptive by taking it out as much as
be more general.
The opposite.
Yes.
Thank you. Appreciate the clarification. Members, this 30 after. We obviously are not done. I really would like to get this done. And so let's just keep going, and I'll try not to ask a lot of questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Section 14 on page 24 is changes to the online learning statute. We made these changes actually on the amendment. If you look on the amendment lines 11 through 15 involves what we changed here. What we did is we have references to an enrolling district in several places, and we've added or charter school to that because we do have charter school providers. What we are trying to do here is close a loophole in the online learning law. If you are a provider or taking part-time students, and as you may know under this law, if you take part-time students, you're taking a portion of the aid from the resident district. That you are subject to the requirements of the online learning law, which includes demonstrating that your courses and curriculum meet academic standards and benchmarks. What we have is a situation where if you're a charter school and you do full-time online learning plus you take part-time students, it is not clear that that charter school then is subject to the requirements of the online learning statute, even though they're taking part-time students and taking that portion of aid from the resident district. So what we're clarifying here is that if you take part-time students, if you're charter school or district, you must demonstrate to the department that your curriculum and courses align to academic standards. Section 15 reinstates the Charter School Advisory Council. This council actually sunset on June 30th, 2007. Sort of missed that one. So what we're trying to do here is revive that Charter School Advisory Council. Section 16 of the bill, if you look at the amendment that was adopted on line 17, starting with line 17, we deleted the new language that says and application on line 32 and 33. If you go to the next page, we have new language that clarifies that the affidavit is in the form and manner as prescribed by the commissioner, so we have some consistency in the application and submission of affidavits. The amendment deleted and application and also deleted on line 5. So line 4 and 5, that new language is now gone. Going to page 27, if you look to your amendment, I'm going to go back to page 26 on the amendment, line 18, if you look at that, at line 18 on the amendment, we're proposing to add new language on line 33. What we've done is deleted the new language that said an application, and we inserted that the affidavit must demonstrate the sponsor's abilities, capabilities, and expertise in fulfilling the responsibilities of a sponsor. Currently, when a sponsor wants to become authorized, what they need to do is they either need to be a school district, which they do by affidavit and tell us that, or they need to be a accredited higher education institution, or if they're a nonprofit, they need to show a fund balance of $2 million, be registered with the Attorney General's Office as a nonprofit, and be registered with the Council of Nonprofits. So that's not a lot of requirements to become a sponsor. And so what we're requesting is additional information that they also demonstrate their abilities and capabilities and expertise in fulfilling the requirements of being a sponsor. On page 27, line 2, I talked about this a little bit, but what we're doing here is instead of saying an application after affidavit, we're being more specific, and so we're inserting new language that says the sponsor must submit an affidavit to the commissioner for each charter school it proposes to authorize. Currently, that is the practice. Once the charter school becomes authorized, they've met the letter of the law of being a sponsor. If they want to actually authorize a charter school, they must submit an application as a sponsor to authorize each charter school they propose to. That has been the practice since day one of the charter school law. We're seeking to clarify that in statute. We're concerned if this is not clarified, then we could have a situation where as soon as a sponsor is authorized, which is pretty minimally under state law, then they can potentially start open charter schools without the state knowing about it until after the fact when they try to collect state aid. And so in order to maintain some quality of our charter school system, we're seeking this language to clarify the existing process. Lines 27, 4 and 5, I talked about that, just deleting the new language. Going to page 27, line 9, after the word 5 on the charter school board, we are proposing to add the word non-related, so the board members need to be non-related to one another. Page 27, line 14, we're striking where it talks about parents may participate in the election, we're striking A and adding are eligible to participate. So it's very clear, again, this has been sort of vague about whether or not parents can participate in charter school board elections, and we're saying, yes, they're eligible to do so. Page 27 after line 21, we're adding language that states that the granting or renewal of a charter school by a sponsor must not be contingent on the charter school being required to contract, lease, or purchase services from the sponsor, and the sponsor is prohibited from entering into a contract to provide management financial services for the school it is authorized to sponsor. So this is sort of a sponsor is required to provide oversight over the charter school. We're trying to ensure that role, and when they're providing the services, it's kind of like providing oversight over yourself. So what we're saying there is their role is to be an oversight, not to be running the school. The second, the first line is that we don't want a situation where a sponsor says, I'll continue to sponsor you if you do X, Y, and Z for me. So we're just clarifying that piece. Lines on the amendment, page 2, lines 5 through 5 and 6, just clarify, renumbers everything in the order it's supposed to be. On page 28, line 24, this is making changes actually, why don't I start with the new language? Excuse me, I'm trying to go back here. If you go to page 28, lines 14, 15, and 16, we're adding some teeth to the conflict of interest statute. We've made some changes last year, and we're making this consistent to what we do with school districts, and that if the school, the charter school's aid may be reduced by the commissioner under section 127A.42 if the charter school board fails to correct violations under the subdivision in a timely manner. Right now, when we do find conflict of interest, there's no penalty, there's no sort of teeth in the law, and there's not a lot we can do, and sort of to kind of catch the attention to correct these conflicts of interest, we're proposing this language, which is consistent to what we have for school districts. Page 24, thank you. We're adding that same language if they fail to correct this in a timely manner, that again, the commissioner can, number one, void the contract at the option of the commissioner, and the charter school's aid may be reduced if they do not correct the conflict of interest. Section 18, this is clarifying existing law. It's kind of what's confusing is that we have some charter schools who believe that they're only subject to the requirements in 124D.10, but over the years, we've had requirements added to charter schools in other statutes of the law, not in 124.10 and 124D.10. And so what we're proposing is saying basically that a charter school is subject to all statutes and rules as provided in this section 124D.10 or any other statutes that they may be written in. So it's very clear they have to follow laws where they're written in statute and rules. Section on page 28 after line 30, we're proposing new language. If you go to the amendment on page 2, lines 11, on down and continuing to the next page. If the first new language we're proposing is lines 27 through 29. Right now, contracts for charter schools between the charter school and the sponsor is required to be no more than 3 years. What we're saying is that after the initial term of contract, that if they meet performance goals such as academic, financial, and operational, they may receive up to a five-year contract from the sponsor. New language on line 30 sort of suggests, and this has been a clarification, because in another part of the section, we basically say that charter school is subject to the Human Rights Act and to the federal special education law. But in this section, some have interpreted to read that providing special education services is permissive. Mm-hmm. And so what we're changing here is not if they will provide, but how they will provide those services.
So just back on, just looking on the amendment, on line 227 to 229 of the amendment. So this is totally new, right?
Yes, I mean,
so we're going from a three-year kind of renewal cycle to a longer-term longer-term cycle, 5 years, once you look past the first initial.
And that is, Mr. Chair, that is permissive, so that the initial three-year contract is up to 3 years, and then if they meet performance goals in the statute for their second and subsequent contracts, they may go up to 5 years. So a sponsor could go anywhere less than 5 years. They wouldn't have to be bound by going with a five-year contract. Yeah, I mean, Mr. Chair, and this has happened, if a sponsor has only issued a one-year contract to the charter school based on they want them to meet performance standards. So even on current law, they're not required to have a three-year. It's up to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, going on to the next page, this is the section subdivision 23 that is the termination and non-renewal of charter school contracts. On line 10, on the amendment, we're clarifying that the proposed action in writing must be by registered mail. Sometimes we've had some disputes about when the date actually started, and so we're basically clarifying that so everyone's clear on the date. On lines 19 and 20, there's also been confusion about, you know, the last day of classes in the school year and how that's interpreted. And so what we're saying is that the sponsors must take final action no later than 15 days before the termination or end of the contract. Line 31, this subdivision C is rewritten because this is confusion on the current statute about voluntary termination if both sides mutually agree to terminate the contract. What we're changing here is that if both sides mutually agree to terminate the contract, both parties must jointly submit in writing to the commissioner its intent to terminate the contract. And if you look at subdivision D, this is the provision that gives the commissioner the authority to sever a contract between a sponsor and a charter school if they have a history of, and we're proposing actually to make that same language, the same authority that sponsors have, and that is for sustained failure to meet requirements for pupil performance contained in the contract, for financial mismanagement, for repeated violations of the law, or for other good cause shown. This actually, subdivision D has only been used once by the department. It's very rarely used. Normally, our practice is to get the sponsors to address the concerns with the charter school, and it's only in extreme cases where we would probably do invoke this subdivision, because our practice, again, is to get the sponsors to maintain oversight and manage their contract.
Representative Erickson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, is other good cause defined in case law?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I know that this provision actually was invoked in a recent case we had with Dakota Academy, and they were very, we went to district court, the sponsor laid out exactly why, what was a good cause was shown, and the judge granted the sponsor's termination or upheld the termination of the sponsor. And so it's normally a pretty, you have to show a pretty strong standard. It can't be just personality based or not based on some strong evidence. And in this case, we would actually have to go to a Chapter 14 hearing, the department would, and so we would have to make our case in front of an ALJ judge before the contract, before the commissioner could terminate a contract between the sponsor and the charter school.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, going on page 19, section, I'm sorry, page 29, section 19, this is defining, again, lease costs and definitions. This is similar to what we use in federal law when we apply the conflict of interest law. So, well, actually, the federal law is much stronger than the state law, so we're aligning the two together, and it provides definitions for related party, affiliate, close relative, person, and control and control, controlling, control by, or other common control with. This is important because, as you know, we want to ensure that our conflict of interest laws are followed, and it's very clear about lease arrangements and how they may be structured.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Section 20 outlines technology and data guidelines. This formalizes some of the currently existing requirements for school districts to provide information about technology strategic planning. We've worked with a committee all fall to identify six areas: instructional technology, technology tools, network and data systems administration, data practices, data management, and facilities infrastructure. We're going to be building a web-based collection to get uniform data about the technology infrastructure in all schools in the state. The idea there is that we could come back next session and inform a funding discussion about where the technology gaps exist with some actual data. We also have some provisions in there for the department to maintain technology guidelines. We will be further detailing requirements in those six areas with our committee, which will have representation from districts across the state, technology directors, and professional organizations. We are also outlining common data definitions for required elements, a common course catalog, and transcript definitions as well.
And if you could just identify yourself for the record.
Excuse me, Kathy Wagner, I'm the Director of Information Technology at the Department of Education.
Thank you, Ms. Wagner. As you know, we heard the Representative Winkler's bill, I think just last week, I can't remember now, a few days ago, on this issue, and I know that the department has also been working with Representative Winkler on that language, and we may want to just look at what's in the Winkler bill and do some comparison to what we have before here in this proposed bill as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on page 30, lines 13 through 15, section 21, that is the revival of the Charter School Advisory Committee. Lines 16 through 19 are simply revisers instructions. If you go back to the amendment on page 4, lines 17 through 27, this is language that was not picked up in the 2007 education bill, and the standard language on grant appropriations allowing any balance in the first year that does not cancel, that it is available the second year. That language was missed for some reason.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, going to Article 3, Special Programs, Section 1 is a request that came from school districts on the notice of an enrollment of a pupil in an instructional program for limited English proficiency students. The 10 days is not sufficient, and the 30 days aligns with what's required in federal law, and so they're requesting that not conflict in the 30 days be used. Section 2 was actually deleted from the bill in its entirety by the amendment that was adopted, so I'll skip over that. And then Section 3 on page 34, this is language that was requested by the Department of Human Services. It strikes not to exceed $350,000 per fiscal year. This language allows them, under current law, they can keep up to 5% retained at the Department of Human Services for administrative costs, and this would just strike, they say, is obsolete language, not to exceed $350,000. Mr. Chair, Article 4, Libraries. As I understand it, on lines 12, the changes in line 17 and 18, lines 12 and 13, 17, 18, this is what they call. They call it the Minnesota Braille and Talking Book Library. Do not call it anymore for the blind and physically handicapped, so we're just conforming to what they do call the facility. On Section 3, this is something that's been provided to other other groups, that they may conduct their meetings of its members by telephone or other electronic means. and under certain conditions that must be met. As you know, they have board members that that live all across the state and have physical handicaps that make it difficult for them to travel sometimes and have meetings, and so this will allow them to do telephone, electronic, as long as they meet certain provisions of the subdivision.
Commissioner, I'm just curious, back on Section 2, because, you know, we have legislated that. Last year, I think here was Representative Faust's bill. It looked like you spent quite a bit of work of trying to make that language more workable, but you're totally backing off here in terms of doing anything this year with this. Is there
Mr. Chair,
reason for that? Or?
The language proposal is trying to clean it up, but there's been some clarifications of that that's needed, and we just felt like we needed to engage stakeholders more before we put language changes forward. So my guess is we'll be back next year for some revisions, and during the interim, we will engage our stakeholders with some of the changes.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this takes us to Article 5, so Dr. Melcher will...
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. There is an amendment on Article 5 right at the beginning on page 4, line 30 of the amendment, and then moving into page 5 of the amendment. Deals with the Minnesota State Academy that's variable, and it would include in the calculation of state special education aids one-on-one behavioral management aids as well as instructional aids. The academies currently have these people employed, and the past practice has been to bill the school districts for the cost of these aids. This would incorporate that into the special education funding formula if these are aids that are included under the child's IEP. In the past, the academies did bill the school districts for these, and the finance department, in reviewing the history of those billings, was not sure that there was clear legislative authority for them to do that billing. And that's the reason for the language on lines 518 and 519, which would allow the academies to retain the amount that they received for fiscal year 2007 from those bills, which was about $289,000. And then, in addition, it was felt important to clarify that in Section 2 here, on page 5, lines 22 through 27 of the amendment, that the academies must seek third-party reimbursement as school districts do, and the academies are also doing this currently, but again, there was lack of any clear legislative authority for them to do the third-party reimbursement, so this is clarifying that they have the authority to seek the third-party reimbursement. Moving back to the bill, Article 5, Sections 1, 2, and 3 are dealing with all-day kindergarten and fees for all-day kindergarten. Section 1 of the bill on page 36, lines 26 through 30, is providing a definition of full-day kindergarten, which is that it means an academic program preparing students to enter first grade the following year, provides a minimum of 850 hours of school year, that's 5 hours a day, for 170 days, includes curriculum and instruction aligned with academic standards. Also tries to clarify the distinction between instructional programs operated in the school district general fund and community education activities. There's been quite a bit of confusion among school districts regarding when is it full-day kindergarten and when is it half-day kindergarten with a half-day child care program. And past department interpretations have suggested that school districts do not have authority to charge a fee for full-day kindergarten, but can charge a fee for a half-day kindergarten with a half-day child care. And quite often, school districts have been in a very awkward position where they want to provide a full-day kindergarten program, and so they advertise it locally as a full-day kindergarten program, and they report it to the department as a half-day program with a half-day child care component because of the fee law issue. And it creates a lot of confusion in our accounting system, and we'd like to get that straightened out so that we have comparable data coming up to the state level. There is an amendment that deals to speak to this issue. We did meet with the Community Education Association. They thought it was important to clarify the accounting as we did. And so on page 5 of the amendment, we've clarified that revenues and expenditures for full-day kindergarten are reported in the school district general fund, and that revenues and expenditures for community education programs for these kindergarten students are reported in the community service fund. And then in Section 2 of the bill, we are including language on page 38, lines 4 through 9, that would clarify that the school district, or provide that the school districts do have the authority to charge a fee for optional full-day kindergarten programs, that the district also provides a free half-time program, and that by doing that, there are two conditions. One of them is that they cannot charge a fee in violation of the federal special education law for programs that are needed to meet a student's individual education plan, and secondly, that they must also provide a sliding fee scale for students that are unable to pay a fee, and that they'll waive it for students that cannot pay the fee. And then Section 3 is amending the list of fees that a school district cannot charge so that it would exclude these fees that are authorized under Section 2.
I suspect we'll probably have a better conversation next week on the definition of full-day kindergarten, and I suspect a number of members will want to kind of wrap their minds around what it means to have these aligned with academic standards, the setting of the minimum hours. I mean, this touches on a bunch of other issues in our state in regards to everything from compulsory aid issues to, you know, what's the public's responsibility for funding kindergarten. I know that those questions, you know, when we walked through it with staff, you know, those popped out, and I suspect a number of our members, particularly our early childhood folks, will have a number of questions there. So I just want to give you a heads up. I think it'll be a good discussion, though. Mm-hmm. One long overdue in our state.
Mr. Chairman, we have two more sections left in the bill. So Article 5, Section 4 deals with the Adult Basic Education Supplemental Service Grant. There has been a cap of $100,000 on the amount of those grants for a number of years. It has not been adjusted over time. The original bill had a 15% a cap that would be a little bit higher than the current $100,000. That would be the equivalent of about $120,000. After discussions with the organizations and our adult basic education people, the amendment in the bill on page 5, line 34, would change that to 25% to provide a little bit more flexibility to the commissioner in terms of awarding these grants. The final section of the bill, Article 5, Section 5, would increase the maximum amount that could be reimbursed for a GED test from $20 to $40. The $20 is something that hasn't been updated for a number of years. This would allow a little bit closer to the full cost to be reimbursed. It's about $100 right now, and this is coming out of the existing money. It's not an increase in the appropriation.
Very good. Well, it took us an hour. Members, any questions or final thoughts? We will be back to this bill next Tuesday, and we'll spend the entire day Tuesday, basically, with this bill and any further amendments. So thank you, Commissioner, and Dr. Melcher, Assistant Commissioner.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too. I'm wondering if someone can move. We have we're kind of backlogged in our minutes here. We have the minutes of February 28th, February 29th, March 4th, and March 6th in the packet. Would someone be so kind as to move? The Representative Welty moves those minutes. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Both same sign. Motion prevails. Members, have a good weekend. We are adjourned until Tuesday.